This is Tall Tale TV, your podcast for sci-fi and fantasy short stories. This story has multiple parts. To listen to the entire story in one place, visit talltaletv.com/series. Steampunk Confederation by Roger Lay. Part 3 of 3. Chapter 8. In the Botanical Gardens. Telford's contact with the Scottish Secret Intelligence Service was Owen Terrell, an experienced agent handler who put the welfare of his Joes first, wherever operational constraints allowed. Telford was in occasional, employed casually. They met in the ancient glass house of the Botanical Garden in the park in the west end of Glasgow. Telford always enjoyed visiting the gardens. He loved the warm, damp atmosphere, the mossy smells, the exotic plants, the white marble statues. He and Owen went through the pantomime of old chums bumping into each other under the main glass rotunda. Having exclaimed their surprise at the lucky coincidence, they retired to the tea rooms in the garden of the former curator's house. The weather was warm enough to sit outside and avoid potential eavesdroppers. Both men wore kilts, although neither of them wore clan tartans. Owen's was a gray Prince of Wales check, and Telford's a tasteful paisley.
"You've done well, Telford," said Owen quietly.
"The tech services people have received their copy of the ironclad plans from Eileen Anderson."
"What do you think will happen next?" asked Telford.
"That's up to the government, but if they have any sense, they'll start building an ironclad immediately. It's an arms race, and we can't let the English get the jump on us."
He laughed.
"Eileen has an added note about steaming up the Thames and pulverizing the Palace of Westminster. I don't suppose it'll come to that, though. Anyway, more urgently, I've another job for you. Normally, it would be above your pay grade, but you're in a privileged position because you know this character, Harry Lampeter."
"Know him? We're intimately acquainted. He tried to kill me a few days ago."
"Well, this could be the making of you, Telford. Your chance of a permanent contract with SIS, even with your plummy accent and stringy calf muscles."
"How did your meeting go?" asked Eileen when she got back to the flat that evening.
"I'm not supposed to talk about it."
Telford was sitting in an armchair, glass in hand. Eileen noticed that his speech was slightly slurred, and the bottle of Grant's, which stood on the coffee table next to him, was half empty. She sat down opposite him and saw he'd been crying.
"What's the matter, Telford? You can tell me. We're on the same side, my love."
Telford got up, found a second glass, and poured a drink for Eileen. He stood, bottle in hand, undecided, then blurted,
"It's that bloody Harry Lampeter again! He's going to blow up Edinburgh with an atom bomb!"
Just for a moment, Eileen, who had been born and raised in Glasgow, wondered if this would be an altogether bad thing. The Edinburghers were such a self-important lot, with their snooty accents and haughtiness. Just because the Scottish Parliament was in Edinburgh, they thought they were more important than the rest of the country. She dismissed the thought. A united front against the old enemy in the south was called for. Internecine grudges could wait. Telford sat down in the chair again and held his head in his hands.
"SSIS want me to kill him," he said. "We went to school together. We used to be friends."
Eileen leaned over and put an arm around his shoulders.
"There, there, Telford. Is this the same man that blew up your dirigible? I'm sure he deserves your enmity, but tell me about the bomb. Where would he get such a thing?"
Telford told Eileen of the plan to blow up the Scottish Parliament.
"But how do SIS know all this? Surely the English would keep it under wraps. The first we'd heard of it would be the explosion."
"Well, it's not so much the English as the Americans. They're the ones who are employing Lampeter. I can only assume there's a double agent, a mole in SIS in London. My handler hinted that King George knows about it, too."
"King George?"
said Eileen, shocked. "He's the only political figure who still spans the North-South divide. He's still king of both countries."
"He wouldn't let the Yanks blow up Edinburgh. Not if he could do anything to prevent it."
Harry stood on the single beach at Landguard Point, watching the USS Hillary Clinton arrive at Felixstowe Docks. Its mission was to bring the bomb to Suffolk. U.S. Marines would transport it to their headquarters at Martlesham, the old U.K. government surveillance site 10 miles away, and he'd take things from there. Harry walked back to the road and kicked the Norton into life. It was time to fetch Tom.
"It's not very big," said Tom, "not considering its destructive potential."
"The best things come in small packages," drawled Colonel Wilson, the CIA chief. Somehow, he reminded Harry of an old movie star called Clint Eastwood, the same rangy, almost haggard look, the same slight swagger. He wore a gray wool jacket, but Harry noticed the bulge under his left armpit. Probably compensating for the size of his prick, he thought. The three of them were standing in a garage area at the Martlesham base. A dozen blank-faced marine guards wearing camouflage fatigues and forage caps guarded the perimeter. Harry thought they were wearing enough armament to take Scotland by themselves. The object of interest was a gray metal box, not much bigger than an overnight case. It had been placed in a trailer attached to the back of Harry's motorcycle.
"It's a modified warhead from an old multiple re-entry vehicle," said the colonel. "The yield is equivalent to about 1,000 tons of TNT, plenty enough to flatten the Holyrood area of Edinburgh."
He pronounced it Edinburgh.
"Might even reawaken the volcano the city's built on."
He chuckled, ran his fingers over the top of the box, and gestured to a figure wearing fatigues, who stood by the door.
"Sergeant Harbaugh here will show you how to arm it."
"You're convinced this is the right thing to do then, Colonel?" asked Harry.
"Sometimes wrong, never hesitant," said the colonel.
He winked and gently punched Harry's shoulder.
"Best of luck, Lampeter. Bring me back a haggis. I've always wondered what they look like."
He turned his head and walked away briskly. Harry looked at the trailer attached to his beloved bike.
"This'll affect the Norton's handling," he complained.
"Perhaps you'll drive a little slower than usual, considering the cargo," said Tom. "Personally, I'll be too nervous to fort near it in case it goes off."
The sergeant stepped between them, holding the key she wore on a lanyard around her neck. She unlocked the box and lifted the lid.
"Right," said Harry. "Show us where to light the blue touch paper, Sergeant."
Chapter 9. The Water of Leith. Harry had rented a cottage in Rosyth, just north of Edinburgh. Tom sat at the dining table rolling himself a cigarette and looking across the front garden to the farmyard on the opposite side of the road.
"I love this part of the world, Harry," he said. "Probably the romantic old asbestos farm buildings, all covered in moss and lichen. I expect they've all got preservation orders on them."
He licked the glue edge of the cigarette paper.
"You know, Harry, I always thought Water of Leith was something you add to single malt whiskey, but it turns out it's a river in the city."
He finished making the roll-up and began shaking again, fumbling with his brass lighter. Harry had been staring into the middle distance. He shook himself, reached across for the lighter, and flicked it into life. Tom lit up and took a deep pull.
"I think you're getting mixed up with Melvin Water, Tom."
"Where's that then, Harry?"
Harry shrugged. Tom continued.
"So, Harry, blowing up Edinburgh with an atom bomb seems a little extreme, even for you."
Harry grimaced.
"You're right, Tom. We can't do it. They may be a bunch of kilt-wearing caber-tossers,
but they don't deserve that. I've been wondering how we can still get the other half of the money without doing the job."
"I doubt if we can, Harry," said Tom. "I mean, either we do it or we don't. There's no in-between where tactical nuclear weapons are concerned. You either get a big bang or nothing at all."
He tried to take another pull, but his cigarette had gone out.
"Yes, I guess we better ditch the bomb and cut our losses. We'll tell the Yanks we placed it and armed it, but it was a dud. We did our best. It wasn't our fault. We can blame Martin Riley and his bacteria."
"Tailor-made cigarettes have got a lot of saltpeter in them," said Tom, reaching for his lighter. "That's why they never go out, even if you leave them in the ashtray. Roll-ups are much healthier. Fewer additives, Just the pure tobacco.
He managed to light up.
What do you propose doing with it?
He nodded towards the gray metal box on the floor near their feet.
I don't fancy taking it back to Suffolk. You know what the Yanks are like. They might use it on London or something.
We'll drop it off the Queensferry Bridge and into the Firth the Forth on our way home, said Harry.
And another thing, I always get mixed up with the Firth of Forth and the Forth of Firth. Why do they have to have such funny names up here?
Harry ignored him. There's no time like the present. Let's get it over with. It's your turn to drive.
Can't it wait, Harry? The rain's pissing down out there.
If we wait for the rain to stop in Scotland, we might be here for a week. Come on, let's do it. Then we can get back to London.
The Queensferry Bridge was a windswept, rustling hulk. The cables frayed and close to parting in places. The rain-washed decking brown and flaking. Dr. Riley's bacteria had eaten the paint and left the steel exposed to the ravages of the atmosphere. Soon, the bridge would collapse, and only the three concrete support towers would be left standing. The depressing lack of maintenance was repeated in the decrepit old Forth Bridge that ran parallel to it. Parts had fallen off into the Firth. The only thing holding it up was faith, hope, and good old Victorian over-engineering. This universal rusting of steel structures made for a gloomy and dystopian environment, and those erected closest to saltwater suffered the most. Tom stopped the bike partway over the bridge and kept the engine ticking over while Harry stepped off. He lifted the bomb out of the trailer and placed it on the parapet. There was a variety of other vehicles passing from both directions. A steam buggy stopped about 25 yards behind them. Telford Stephenson stepped out of the passenger side. He pulled a revolver from each of the pockets of his waxed cotton riding coat and pointed them at Harry.
"Don't move, Harry!" he shouted through the wind and rain. "We've been watching you ever since you crossed the border. I thought you were going to blow up Holyrood. What made you change your target? No, don't bother answering. I don't really care."
He began blasting, somewhat inexpertly, with both guns in Harry's direction. Harry dived over the edge of the parapet, taking the bomb with him, and began the long fall towards the cold, black waters below. Tom roared off in the direction of Edinburgh. Telford looked over the edge as the falling figure splashed into the water.
"Goodbye, old friend," he muttered, his tears lost among the raindrops spattering his face.
"How did it go, Telford?"
asked Eileen when he arrived back at the flat hours later.
"Did you arrest Harry Lampeter, or did you have to shoot him?"
She stared, unblinking, holding his wet coat, ready to hang it up.
"I think I winged him, but the fall will have killed him."
"What fall, Telford?"
she asked.
Hours later, shaky Tom found Harry lying unconscious on a small beach on the Edinburgh side of the Firth. He dragged him to the trailer, manhandled him into it, then headed south. When he was safely clear of Edinburgh and out onto the countryside, he pulled off the road and made Harry as comfortable as possible. Fortunately, none of Telford's bullets had found their target. Tom drove for Carlisle as fast as he could and checked Harry into the hospital there less than 2 hours later. The gray metal box had smashed into the waters of the Firth the Forth beside Harry and sunk into its depths. The Ideonella bacteria had already begun eating its plastic components. The current rolled it gently out into the North Sea, where it eventually sank harmlessly into the mud and began a slow and uneventful decomposition. 3 weeks later, Harry, Emma, and Elsa Nielsen caused a stir as they entered the Barren Penguin. The women were dressed to the nines with feathered bonnets, high heels, and calf-length dresses. Harry wore a dark velvet suit, silk shirt, and fedora. The 20 or so regulars raised a cheer, both at the return of Harry after his convalescence and also in the hope of a round of free drinks. The three joined Tom at his corner table.
"Hello, Harry. You look well. Emma and Elsa been looking after you, have they?"
Tom winked and pushed his tobacco tin towards Harry. Harry pushed it towards Emma. She smiled, opened it, and began to roll a cigarette for Tom.
They've been keeping me warm, Tom. I'll say that for them.
And the Yanks, Harry? What about them?
It seems Colonel Wilson didn't have the presidential approval for his plan. Apparently, there have been some telegraphic exchanges between the White House and Windsor Castle. The upshot is that the Colonel is no longer head of the CIA, and the grateful new director, with my promise of our discretion, has coughed up the rest of the money. Here's your share. Harry tossed a thick bundle of notes onto the table in front of Tom. Emma finished making the roll-up, lit it, and placed it in Tom's mouth.
"It looks like it's your turn then, Tom,"
she said. But Tom had already spirited the money away and was shaking again. This time, partly at least, with laughter. Chapter 10. A Promenade at Southwold. A year later. Telford was sitting at his table, writing a letter to Eileen, when the cell door opened. He looked up.
"Hello, Harry. I thought you'd turn up eventually," he said, as his erstwhile schoolmate walked in.
"Been here long, tell us?"
asked Harry, looking around at the whitewashed walls, the single gas lamp, and the riveted steel door.
27 days, Harry, ever since I was captured at Southwold. I nearly got away with it. Eileen and I were the only members of the crew not in uniform."
"But you were wearing a kilt, Telford. It's a bit of a giveaway in Suffolk."
Harry sat on the iron-framed bed, then lay back with his hands behind his head and closed his eyes.
"What's the story, then? Tell me about it."
"Well, Eileen wangled us berths on the SSS Revenge's maiden voyage. The sea trials had gone well, although the captain said she'd wallowed a little in the heavy swell, whatever that means. Anyway, we steamed out of Glasgow, up through the Caledonian Canal, and then turned south. We stopped at Edinburgh to take on supplies. Dignitaries came aboard. There were parties, photographers, stories in the paper. That was probably our undoing. We continued south down the east coast. The plan was to steam up the Thames, fire a few salvos at the House of Parliament to put the wind up the English government, and then steam back, show of strength and all that. Eileen was so excited she didn't sleep for 3 days. I think she was hoping to fire a round herself."
"So what went wrong?" asked Harry.
"Well, it was the bloody Yanks, wasn't it?" said Telford. "They torpedoed us in Sole Bay, off Southwold in Suffolk. It wasn't much of a torpedo, probably clockwork or something, but it made quite a bang, and we started taking in water through a hole in the stern. The bilge pumps couldn't keep up. The boat was heavy with all the iron plating on it. So the captain decided to beach her. It was a race against time. We put on full steam straight towards the shore. The holidaymakers didn't know what to do. Probably thought it was a stunt. Anyway, somebody must have telegraphed the militia, because by the time we reached the shallows and abandoned ship, there were about 20 of them waiting for us. You can't put up much of a fight when you're waist-deep in water and looking up the gun barrels of a squad of redcoats."
"So they arrested you?" asked Harry.
He sat up, pulled a hip flask from his coat pocket, and poured a large shot into Telford's tin mug.
"I say, Harry, you are a gent," said Telford.
"Slangvar, old chap," he said as he downed it.
Harry poured him another.
"Sorry, Harry. It's been a while. I'll sip this one."
"So, there you are, wading ashore with Eileen in your arms. Then what happened?"
"Well, as I said before, we nearly got away with it. We were both in civvies, and some of the crowd had waded out to get a better look. So we sort of mixed in with them while the militia were concentrating on the chaps in uniform. We came ashore, actually. I bought us both an ice cream cone at a kiosk in the promenade to help us blend in. Bloody good ice cream it was, too. But, as you said, the kilt gave me away."
"You should have taken it off, Telford. Nobody would have noticed you in your pants at the seaside."
"Afraid I wasn't wearing any, Harry. Tradition and all that. Anyway, I told Eileen to leave me. She walked to the railway station and made her way back to Scotland over the next couple of days. She had a few sticky moments, but you English aren't big on security and identity papers, and the border's pretty porous in places."
"I'm glad she got home safe, Telford. She sounds like a gutsy sort of woman. Just what you need."
"Anyway, that's the story. I'm awaiting trial as a spy and can expect to be found guilty. I'll be executed at some unspecified time in the future.
The rest of the chaps will be all right. They were in uniform, so the Geneva Convention applies. They'll probably be exchanged and sent home in a few months. That seems to be the way it works. Meantime, I haven't heard a peep out of my employers, the Scottish Secret Intelligence Service.
Who was it that said military intelligence is a contradiction in terms? Asked Harry.
He stood up and began removing his clothes.
I say, Harry, said Telford.
Aren't we a bit too old for that sort of thing? We're supposed to have grown out of it.
Shut up and put this on.
Harry pulled a dark wig out of his pocket and threw it to Telford.
We'll exchange clothes, and you can piss off back over the border. Tom's waiting outside with the Norton.
Harry sat at the writing desk, wearing his friend's kilt and linen shirt. He tucked his hair into Telford's tam-o'-shanter and sat with his head on his hands as if upset. Dressed in Harry's velvet suit and long-haired wig, Telford banged on the cell door and stood with his back to it as the guard entered.
I'm sorry we can't help you, Telford,
said Telford to his supposed self, using his best estuary accent. He walked past the guard and out of the cell. Harry gave Telford 24 hours, and then declared himself to the guards. But nobody seemed to care much who occupied the cell, as long as they had somebody under lock and key. 2 days passed before a guard came and escorted Harry, in handcuffs, to the visitation room. Only the centermost desk was occupied. The guard pushed Harry into the chair opposite Miss Rigby and stood behind him.
"Hello, Miss R," said Harry. "Come to bail me out, have you?"
"If I had my way, Lampeter, I'd leave you here to rot at the king's pleasure."
She was wearing her usual mannish gray suit, a white shirt and regimental tie. Her hair was as short as ever.
"That bloody man Crisp is back in the driving seat at SIS. The Yanks have been interfering again. You seem to be his blue-eyed boy. He won't have a word said against you. He's got another job for you, in Ireland this time. I'll be interested to see what sort of balls up you make of it. How they can still want you after you lost their precious atom bomb, I don't know. You realize they'd rigged it to go off as soon as you tried to set the timer? You're lucky to be here. By rights, you should be a cloud of radioactive molecules dissipating into the atmosphere high above Scotland. Another thing I don't understand is why you helped Telford Stephenson escape. After all, according to your statement, he tried to shoot you on the Queen's Ferry Bridge."
"I said he fired at me, Miss Rigby. But Telford is a crack shot. He won a silver medal in the school's pistol shooting championship back in the day. He missed me on purpose. Gave me the opportunity to jump and take my chances in the water. I couldn't let you bastards kill him. I couldn't see him die at the end of a rope. It's not civilized."
"He's a spy. He knew the risks he was taking," she hissed.
"Come on, Miss R," said Harry. "It's all a laugh. It's all a game. You couldn't give me a handjob under the table for old time's sake, could you? I've been on my own for days."
Miss Rigby stood and gathered her things.
"Screw you, Lampeter. You can make your own way back to London."
She stormed out of the room, trying to knock the bolted down tables and chairs aside. The guard came over and unlocked Harry's cuffs. They both watched Miss Rigby's attempts to slam the door as she left, but it had a spring closer. Harry looked at the guard. "If you don't ask, you don't get. It's always worth a try, don't you think?"
"You're free to go, Mr. Lampeter," said the guard evenly. "Follow me and we'll collect your things."
That evening in Glasgow, Telford knocked on the door to Eileen's flat. In one hand, he held a bunch of roses. In the other, an Indian takeaway. Under his arm was a chilled bottle of champagne, and in his trouser pocket, his mother's engagement ring. The door opened, and Eileen stood there, looking at him for a moment.
"Telford, where the bloody hell have you been?"
she asked, before she threw her arms around him, pulled him inside, and closed the door. Steampunk Confederation is one of the stories in Roger Lay's recently released speculative fiction collection, Dead People on Facebook. All the stories in the collection have been published, podcast, or broadcast in the last year, and steampunk author Jessica Lucci has included Dead People on Facebook in her January reading list for 2019. His other sci-fi book is Chronoscape,
a science fiction novel about time and alternate realities. That concludes this three-part story. I hope you guys liked it. Personally, steampunk is one of my favorite genres, and I loved the idea of society regressing to that point. If you enjoyed this story, stay tuned, because Roger Lay is lining up to be a bit of a regular on the channel. Thanks for listening. I'm Chris Herron, and that's it for today's Tall Tale TV.